Hello, and welcome to episode number 92 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Over the course of the 80 or so years that make up what is colloquially known as the modern UFO phenomenon, various hypotheses have been generated to make sense of not only the remarkably sophisticated craft that seem to be leagues beyond the technology of any modern nation-state present on the planet, but also of the apparently non-human beings who occupy them, and of the high strangeness that seems so often to be part and parcel with these anomalous encounters. Because mainstream Western civilization has been firmly in the clutches of reductionistic physicalism as a model of reality for the entire duration of the modern UFO phenomenon, the vast majority of the hypotheses generated thus far have been based on this underlying materialist framework. What's strange about this, though, is that physicalism has been dead in the water for quite some time now. Not only is it woefully misguided in some of its claims, but it is demonstrably untenable based on modern research findings. Bernardo Kastrup is a renowned contemporary philosopher who is one of the most vocal voices in the world today, calling physicalism's bluff. He counters the materialist delusion with a model he calls analytic idealism, arguing that reality is fundamentally a mental construct, a process of mentation, and we, along with all other sentient beings in the cosmos, are what he deems alters of original mind, or what others might call source consciousness. In this, the second of my two-part interview with Bernardo, we cover a variety of topics engaging with how idealism might present some very interesting and encouraging possibilities for further research. The issues addressed from the perspective of idealism include high strangeness and the peculiar humanoid, almost neo-human body type of many of the anomalous beings encountered across history. While the UFO phenomenon has undoubtedly proven to be one of, if not the most enigmatic of modern topics, in this discussion we consider the insights that a metaphysical model like idealism might open up in our process of inquiry. All this and more coming up in this, the 92nd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. Bernardo, you've spoken before of being animated and directed by what you have described as a daemon. I'm wondering if you could briefly describe what you mean by that and how your life has been impacted by this unseen figure or force.
So I use the figure of the daemon as a metaphor. There isn't a two-armed, two-legged creature in my mind that right. forces me to do what I do. That's not what is meant. I meant it almost poetically, in the sense that Patrick Harpur means it in his corpus, in his wonderful books. Patrick Harpur, friend of John Mack, one of the most criminally underrated scholars in the world today, in my mind. What I mean by this is that some of us, if they are knocked hard enough by life, if life puts you down enough times, then you suffer enough, which is regrettable, but suffering is tool number one of understanding. If you don't suffer, you're not going to even try to understand. You're not even going to ask the questions, let alone come up with answers. But if you've been knocked enough, there comes a point in your life, in your maturity, if you're paying attention to. Many people are knocked down a lot by life, but they don't pay attention. If you pay attention, at some point you realize that there is an impersonal force within us and acting through us, a mental force that doesn't have our individual well-being as a priority. Often it doesn't even have it in mind at all, let alone as a priority. There is something nature tries to do through us, which is not the agenda of the ego, of the personal self. We refer to it when we say that people undermine themselves. People are always undermining themselves. Or when we say somebody is doing something crazy and irresponsible. What we mean by that is that person is taking actions that don't align with the reasonable agenda of the ego. So need to lead them to personal harm or personal disadvantage. Like if you leave a very promising career just when you're about to explode in terms of financial gain. People say, well, my mother is very good at this, of saying, no, you're undermining yourself. You shouldn't do this. When people do that, they are acting as per the direction of the impersonal within them. So I just call this force that we all have, some of us recognize, some of us don't, but we all have it. I call it the diamond. Because as Jung said, it gives you some kind of moral ground to externalize it. It allows you to sort of, you can't really bargain with the diamond, but you can reason with it. You can say, I will do your bidding, but I need a roof over my head and I need food on my plate tomorrow, because if I die, or if I have no means to act in this world because I will be living in a shelter, I can't do your bidding. So allow me to care for myself enough that I can be useful to you. So if you externalize the diamond, you can have this kind of inner conversation. If you don't externalize the diamond, you will either not see it at all. You will think that everything you do, you decided it. It's your own personal agenda. And therefore you will blame yourself for every setback you have in life. Or you will identify with the diamond. You will think that you are it. And then you can become a Hitler or a Putin. Psychology calls it ego inflation. You can become a Trump, who is extremely, in my view, pathological in this regard. There is a demonic force operating through him. That's why almost half of the American population latches onto that. There is truth to that. There is a movement of the collective psyche here that cannot be dismissed or ignored or poo-pooed. No, it's real. It's authentic. There is authenticity and validity to that. Not in the most obvious ways. I don't mean to endorse nonsense here. We make a mess of these transpersonal forces. We misinterpret them, we misportray them. But there is a transpersonal force in action here, and it is expressing itself through one particular character. But that character thinks that that force is him. And that's when things can very quickly go to hell. So it's very useful to externalize the diamond, not to make that mistake. Because if you don't, you either touch it and it's 2,000 volts going through your system and you're toast, or you will ego inflate and you can be a catastrophically destructive force in the world, even though the energy, that wave that you're riding, is not necessarily destructive. A tsunami doesn't have the agenda of killing people or causing suffering. It's a force of nature. The diamond is a force of nature. It needs to be interacted with and given a direction so it can express itself in functional ways. But if we identify with it, it can become tragically dysfunctional. Putin identifies with the diamond of the Russian psyche, the entirety of the Russian psyche, of the Slavic world. He thinks it's him. And therefore, it becomes logically justified to let tens of thousands to die horrible deaths or be orphans because of the higher abstract goal of the future of the Slavic peoples. That's what you get if you don't externalize the diamond. So I think it's useful to use this name, diamond.
Indeed. And I'm thinking too about that show Encounters again, I think was one of the first episodes, I think, where that guy, Matthew Roberts, who was a cryptologist or something, and he talked about being 2 years away from his pension. You might remember this in one of the episodes. And he left to talk about this because he felt like it was something bigger than him, more important than him, and it's for all of us kind of thing. Which also makes me reflect again on the one person you said in that second episode that said, the question is, what are we? Who are we? Yeah. Right? And even when you're speaking to some of the pathological expression, one of the things I like to point out to people is that you have to have a healthy ego in order to transcend it. You can't transcend something that's never healthily formed. Okay, so I wanted to ask you something about idealism and also about the Essentia Foundation. You recently spoke about your conviction that idealism will eventually reign triumphant as the consensus reality paradigm in Western civilization. I'm just curious to hear your sense of how far along we are in that process compared with, say, 10 years ago. And what do you expect that process of uptake will look like moving forward? Will it be in fits and starts, slow and steady? What do you expect that will look like?
Just to put it in context first, idealism has been mainstream in India for 3,500 years. And India is the most populous country in the world. So it's not like at the level of humanity, it's not an oddity. On the contrary, idealism has been mainstream in the West between late 18th and mid 19th century, from about 1780, Kant, all the way into the young Hegelians, which turned into Marxism at some point. But in those years, between 1780 and, say, 1850, idealism was mainstream in Western civilization. It was mainstream in Europe. Even the church embraced Hegelian idealism, the notion of the absolute mind as the ground of reality, and the notion of the historical dialectics, in which that mind through us, through civilization, through cultures, through societies, interacts with itself in progressive steps of deeper and deeper understanding. This was mainstream, and it's flat out idealist. Now, even though Hegel was the supreme obscurantist, we can discern enough with confidence in his tortuous writing that it was idealism through and through, all right? And it was not Kantian epistemic idealism. It was ontic idealism. So we've been without it now for less than 200 years. Materialism had a fantastic run from about the 1850s to the 1990s. Towards the end of the 1990s, panpsychism was gathering momentum because of this acknowledgement that, you know, materialism just doesn't work. It's too much of an appeal to miracle. It's too unparsimonious. It doesn't have nearly enough explanatory power. Too many unresolved questions that are probably fundamental contradictions, not problems to be solved in the future. So that awareness began to grow late last century, and this century things are very different. You had the four horsemen of the apocalypse in the noughties. But if you think and compare that ethos with the ethos of the 2020s, it's water to wine. In the world today, the four horsemen wouldn't even have started, because the whole thing sounds so silly, those appeals to eliminativism, consciousness is an illusion. Wait a moment, an illusion is already a content of consciousness. So aren't you contradicting yourself here? I mean, or the refusal to acknowledge the existence of the hard problem of consciousness, or the insistence on behaviorist thinking, that mind is its behavior. Wait a moment, if something behaves, there has to be that which behaves. You cannot reduce everything to a behavior. There has to be something that behaves. So that stuff, only 20 years ago, that stuff today, it would sound ludicrous. It wouldn't survive the first round on Twitter. It would be crushed. So things are different already, Darren. It's very difficult today to find a physicalist willing to have a public live debate in which the physicalist is willing to actually defend physicalism.
As you pointed out before, even be able to defend physicalism. Sometimes what they actually postulate is not actually physicalism, and they just assume what they've inherited because of consensus reality is the case.
Most people who are in other fields of studies and they claim to be physicalists, a lot of those people, even academics, do not know what physicalism entails and implies. So they just take the label out of their environment and they use it without knowing what it actually means. But others are supposed to know better. So I had a debate some time ago with Patricia Churchland, who has been a pretty activist, eliminativist. An eliminativist is somebody who says, at least many of our conscious experiences don't really exist. We don't really experience what we think we do. Actually, we may experience nothing. We just think that we experience. I mean, it's probably the most absurd idea in the history of human thought. Not only the history of philosophy, the history of everything. Nothing could be more self-contradictory than an idea like this, which they dress up in all kinds of conceptual acrobatics to give it a veneer of maybe depth and plausibility so people can think, this is so absurd, but if this person is saying this, there must be something to it that I don't understand. Well, guess what? There's nothing there. There's nothing there. It's just the bullshit it seems to be. So here's Patricia Churchland, who for 40 years was an eliminativist. And then a debate between me and her was organized by the Institute of Art and Ideas, live, online. First thing she says, her opening statement, I'm not a materialist. I am agnostic. I'm open-minded. I just follow the evidence. Well, okay, after 40 years. So you don't get a physicalist who is willing now to debate by defending physicalism. Most of the debates I had were discussions about idealism, clarifications of idealism. What the physicalist did in the debate was to interact with me in order to clarify what I mean by idealism. So you can't find the physicalist. You surely can find someone on the streets who would love to sit on a debate with me. But academics with some visibility, with some respectability, were willing to come and defend physicalism in a live, online, public debate with me. If you are one in this audience and you think I'm wrong, then drop me a message and let's organize a live debate. I'm not going to debate everybody who wants to debate me, otherwise I would do nothing else in my life. But if you're an academic with some level of visibility and respect and, you know, a reputation of your own and you're willing to do that, I'm sure we can find some big shows willing to host that debate. Let's do that. But it hasn't happened. Somebody like me putting forward a non-physicalist metaphysics is no longer ridiculed. 20 years ago, anyone, doesn't matter how good the argument would have been, anyone saying, I think physicalism is not right because, oh, immediately derided as some new age, some flaky new age nonsense, spiritual, religious, something.
I think people have called you a mystic, as if that's a word to like put you down and dismiss you.
Yeah, that used to happen a lot more, like 15 years ago. Now it's, no, nobody with any level of self-respect would really call me a mystic. The world has changed in these 15 years because you're just basically ridiculing yourself. You're basically signing a piece of paper saying, I don't even begin to know what this guy has written or said. So that doesn't happen anymore. I'm not derided and ridiculed. I'm disagreed with, but that's different. And I'm even disagreed with at an emotional level. I had an attempt at a debate with philosopher Tim Modlin, philosopher of physics, who likes to, you know, entertain all these fantasies about Everettian parallel universes and invisible pilot waves and all this stuff for which we have absolutely zero empirical evidence. You could call it pseudoscience because this stuff doesn't make any predictions. But in his opening the debate, he already went so emotional, insulting and everything. I was surprised by that. I made my opening statement. I thought we were going to have a friendly debate. And then that, I left the debate. There was no ground to have a conversation. I mean, he wanted to have a schoolyard brawl. And I thought, well, if you are to have it, let's at least do it in the schoolyard. Not in an online debate with aspirations to an intellectual exchange. So I had to leave that debate. I don't know whether it will ever be made public or not. I don't mind if it's made public. But this is new too. People feel threatened. Because the point I was making was that the latest experiments in foundations of physics defy physical realism, the notion that physical entities exist with defined properties before measurement. That was my opening statement. And to evoke that kind of violent emotional reaction from someone who is a physicalist, obviously, means that I'm taken seriously. And because otherwise this person wouldn't have felt threatened. Team modeling would never have felt threatened by my opening statement 15 years ago. He would probably have just smiled and remained in his calm, self-reassured self. But he went ballistic. Now, that shows something about the different psychology in our times. People who disagree with me feel threatened by me because they know that there is something to it. They may disagree with it, but it's not nonsensical. It's, in fact, very hard to refute it, very hard to disagree with it. And therefore, they feel threatened. That's also a sign of the times. That's a new development. So if you ask me, how long will it take? I don't know. But I can tell you with absolute certainty that the change in the last 15 years has been more than measurable. It's very clear. It is changing. And it will continue to change. I think before 2050, it will be in a very different place. And I think even the UAP story that's very carefully being let out now will dovetail with that. And our children and grandchildren will live under a narrative in terms of which to relate to reality that is radically different from the one we had when we grew up in the 70s and the 80s.
Indeed, what I hear you saying is the tectonic shifts have already been well underway, and it's sort of more about the surface level acknowledgement that really has to take place. So let me just quickly ask one follow-up question in light of that. I think about human dignity and human sense of purpose and how physicalism has reduced that. And I've heard you speak before, and I have as well, about how some of the pathologies we see in modern life can be related directly to materialism and reducing everything to the surface layer that can be measured through the scientific method. So I'd like you to speak about that, about how you think people will be ennobled by something like idealism again, and what is the vision and mission of Essentia Foundation? Is it connected to that, not just getting it right, but also trying to instill the sense of purpose again in human experience?
Look, I'm not going to blame materialism for everything that's going wrong in the world today. That would be naive. There is a host of causes for the mess we find ourselves in consistently. But materialism is definitely one of them. And how does it play its role? Look, we do not identify with the neuronal activity inside our skull. We don't see our neurons. We don't experience the world in the form of firing neurons. Those firing neurons, although we know they are here, it's a kind of abstraction. It's abstract knowledge. We know they're there, but we don't have any direct acquaintance with them, or maybe such a direct acquaintance that we don't even see, like fish don't see water. Be that as it may, what we do identify with is with our conscious inner life. We identify with our thoughts, with our beliefs, with our feelings, our emotions, our memories. We identify with qualitative stuff, the stuff we feel from within. That's what we identify with. That's what we are, pre-theoretically. Before theory, that's what we are. It's our conscious inner life. Materialism tells you that the world is fundamentally different from consciousness. The world is not qualitative, it's purely quantitative. It's geometrical relationships, mathematical relationships. It's pure abstraction. We don't identify with that. And materialism goes ahead and says, this qualitative stuff that we identify with, that's epiphenomenal. It's a sort of a byproduct, a side effect of material arrangements. It doesn't even have any causal power. No, there is no reason for this to be there. It's a footnote at best. And what that does, it makes us feel like aliens in this universe. Because the universe is supposed to be substantially and fundamentally other than us. The universe is not made of thoughts and emotions and values and beliefs and memories. It's supposed to be made of mass, charge, momentum, spin, frequency, amplitude. We don't relate to that. So materialism renders us as aliens in life and the universe. We don't belong here. We are an anomaly. And this is a crushing understanding of life. If these are the terms through which you understand your existence as a living being, God help you. You will need a superhero act of a Nietzschean scale to invent meaning for your life. Because you're not supposed to be here. You don't belong here. You're an anomaly. You're a footnote. You're a byproduct, a side effect. Nothing is about you. You don't count. You have no causal influence in the world. Only your brain and your body has. Imagine that. And the result of believing this and trying to extract some worth out of life is the enterprise of Nietzsche. That Nietzsche is the prototypical Western man. He saw it decades before everybody else saw, and he had to live with and deal with the consequences of this decades before anybody else had. And he did it in a metacognitive way. He knew that that's what he was trying to do. Most of us are trying to do just that without even knowing that we're trying to do that. We just fall for depression and lack of meaning and anxiety and all that. Nietzsche has shown us what it takes for you to sort of try to impart meaning to life, not as a god, but as a little human being who is an anomaly, a side effect of something else. You need to muster the Superman into existence. Is it possible? Well, let's look at how Nietzsche did. He became crazy. He went into a psychiatric hospital, and then as an invalid at home for the last 10 years of his life. It is not possible. Nietzsche's way of trying to confront the beast, staring the beast in the face and winning, shows us that you can't do that. So we don't try. What do? We try to distract ourselves through reality television, buying new pairs of shoes, eating a lot of meat, thinking that you're entitled by God himself to eat meat, despite of what it's doing to the planet. Alcohol, cigarettes, status, big addiction. To be a social media influencer. Now that's fluid compensation there for the world to see, or people having grotesquely public midlife crisis, as Elon Musk. These are the addictive, desperate patterns we engage in to distract ourselves from the problem. The problem being we regard ourselves as anomalies, as side effects. We don't belong here. Idealism is the opposite. Idealism is you identify with your conscious inner life. Okay, the universe is a conscious inner life that presents itself to you from your perspective as what we call matter. Matter is a dashboard representation of the real states of the world, which are mental states. So we belong here. We are at home. And we will never leave home. We are entitled to this, not in the sense of entitlement, social entitlement, but in the sense that we are products of a mental universe.
Like a birthright.
It's a birthright. Exactly. It's a birthright. We belong here. Nothing is wrong. This is not a mistake. This is not an anomaly. We are nature expressing itself. Now, suddenly the world becomes a cradle, a tough cradle, because we do a lot of crap to each other, but a cradle. Nonetheless, we are no longer anomalies. Now, this thought, people will understand it conceptually, but we are so alienated from nature that most people hearing me say this, although they understand it conceptually, they will not really understand it, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. It will not sink in into the soma, into the body as a lived reality, as a lived experience, because we are so grotesquely alienated from nature, from the facts of the matter.
And indoctrinated into that perspective as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And because of that, the UAPs are aliens from another galaxy. The word alien has multiple denotations and connotations, right? It can be alien in the sense that it's from another planet, or it can be alien in the sense that it's us, but we are alienated from ourselves. So we see ourselves as an alien from another planet. Our situation, it would be comical if it weren't tragic. 100 years from now, there will be lots of academic grants being given to social scientists and psychologists to try to figure out how we found our way to this grotesque situation. How we could have believed in all this crap that we honestly believe in today. How did it happen to the human species to go so wrong and to be so convinced that they are right? Not only that, to be convinced that everybody before them was ridiculously wrong and to be condescending about our ancestors. I mean, this is phenomenal. It's amazing stuff. It's a great time to be alive and experience this, because otherwise you wouldn't believe it.
Exactly. The era of aberration. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. You read it in books, you will not believe. People reading books 100 years from now, books telling them, this is what we believed in today, this is how we live, they'll go like, no, this cannot be.
It's gone. Absolutely. I agree. And I think if you study history, it's only then that you sort of see this in the correct light in terms of perspective. Just want to give a shout out to what the Essentia Foundation is doing and your work in general. I really do think it helps to establish again the sense of purpose and meaning, and again, puts us in center stage. And like we've been saying, this sense of birthright that we are supposed to be here. And once you believe that you're supposed to be here, then you begin to allow yourself to ask the questions, what now should I do? What am I? Right? Things like this. What is this?
Yeah. So the charter of the foundation is to promote science and philosophy that is related to idealism. This idea that there is an objective world out there. It's beyond our individual minds, but that world is also mental, just like we are mental. And just like our inner mentation presents itself to external observation as the matter in our body, so does the inner mentation of the universe present itself to our observation as the cosmos, the so-called physical cosmos. So we feel that idealism is too much associated with spiritual or meditative paths. I mean, not that there is anything wrong about that. There isn't, but it creates this social idea that the only way you can argue or you can defend idealism is through some kind of direct spiritual insight. And we think that no, there are very solid stories for idealism, perhaps the most solid, based on reason and evidence alone, without requiring any kind of direct introspective insight or spiritual enlightenment or any of that. So that's what we try to promote. We try to promote this notion that there are very good rational empirical reasons to adopt idealism as the only tenable metaphysics in the world today. But the mainstream media doesn't reflect that. The mainstream media is telling you, well, if you want to believe in idealism, you got to be enlightened. Well, you certainly, if you're enlightened, you'll probably believe in idealism. I don't know it because I'm not enlightened, but everybody I know that seems to be enlightened agrees that idealism is true. So that seems to be the case. But I think there are lots of people out there like me who are not enlightened and will probably never be enlightened. And there is a very good story for them too. That's what the foundation tries to do.
Wonderful. Well, one other thing I wanted to ask you, even when you think about David Grush talking about these revelations that there's even been accords, right, agreements between some groups in the military and some of these others, the reason I bring it up to you is because, like you, I tended to think more in terms of this absurdity thing and like weak objectivity and different dreamscapes sort of bleeding together. But it's interesting if you also bring in the notion of somehow there being this navigation between different points in time, and that what we may be partially seeing, again, because we are betrayed by assuming time is linear because of our experience, But if it's actually very different than that, and then once you have some example of time travel, once that's been invented, then suddenly all bets are off because origin points no longer are linear, right? In terms of a past causes something in the future. So I'm just curious if you've thought about that as one additional feature to what some of these others might be in addition to sort of these interpenetrating dreamscapes.
No, although I admit that the fact that some of these craft have been in a hangar for 80 years is not what I expected, and that it forces me to reconsider some of my views, I still feel that applying human categories to try to make sense of this is a bit naive.
Right.
Categories like time travel, this is a very human category. Or an extra dimension of space, physical dimension of space, a very human category. Or the notion that they are here to do genetic research to do a survey of the planet. These are all human categories.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the phenomenon is restricted to human categories. So I would hesitate about entertaining too far the notion of time travel. But I do concede, again, that a craft in a hangar for 80 years, that changes, forces me to reconsider something. It's not a fundamental change because I already acknowledged the physical phase of it from the beginning. But it's a change in degree that is strong enough that maybe I have to reevaluate some of my ideas. But I still feel this knee-jerk reaction of saying, no, don't apply human categories.
Right. So then what would you do with the humanoid body type?
I haven't seen one. And I don't have any information about it. Does it have DNA similar to ours? Is it a double helix as well? What about its metabolism? Are they carbon-based? Do they burn ATP? For me to have an opinion, I would have to know more than just, well, there is a body, but that's just a word, body.
So let me just say this, to like tease you with it. Part of the information coming out is that even the bodies, because again, I would say to you, I know this is hard to really grapple with, but that the bodies being held in freezers is just as real as the craft in hangars for 80 years. But that the shock to the system, and part of the reason why the cover-up was suddenly so tight, is because they did study the DNA, and there was a link between us and these others, like on a genetic level.
Let me be careful in how I frame this. The existence of Homo sapiens sapiens is not trivial to account for. We are the only species on the planet that has unplugged from the web of instinct. We are the only species that has become metacognitive to a degree in which deliberation overwhelms instinct. Everything else, including cetaceans, pachyderms, advanced mollusks, apes, higher apes, everybody else is plugged straight into the web of instinct. None of what they do brings the planet out of balance. We unplugged. We develop technology to a degree that brings the very existence of the ecosystems on this planet in danger. We are anomalies. And not only that, although anatomically there is evidence for our existence since 200, maybe 300,000 years, there is only evidence for our ability to think symbolically, in other words, to replace elements of reality with concepts, then work out the concepts in our heads as if they were real, and then project it all back to create stuff or do stuff. This ability to think symbolically, there is only evidence for it for about 30 or 50,000 years. You know, probably not more than 50,000 years. And this is discombobulating because what it means is that although the genetic mutations that would allow for this symbolic thinking, they probably were there since 200,000 or 300,000 years, they lay dormant and unused for well over 100,000 years until it was, for some reason, quote, discovered by its owner. In other words, this is a genetic mutation that was fixed in our genome without conveying absolutely any fitness or survival advantage. because it lay dormant for a couple of 100,000 years before it was discovered by a human. There is a book by the curator of the Hall of Human History of the American Museum of Natural History. His name is Ian Tattersall. He has published a book called Masters of the Planet. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah.
And there is a point in the book in which he says, the fact that we have this ability encoded in our genome for no survival advantage, because it lay dormant for most of our existence, the fact that something like this could at all happen, we can only believe that something like this could happen, only because obviously it did happen. Otherwise, we would be entitled to say, forget the nonsense. This cannot happen. This is not a trivial mutation. It's a very specific and spectacular mutation. It distinguishes us from the whole of the rest of nature. It's the most spectacular mutation in the history of life on Earth, the whole 4 billion years on it. And it happened for no reason. And it was affixed in our genome for no reason. Come on, this is absolutely implausible. It's beyond implausible. So our existence as metacognitive, symbolic thinking apes is discombobulating. In this context, the idea that something else engineered us doesn't sound as absurd, does it? It doesn't, I mean, it's implausible, but next to the other implausible, it sounds quite reasonable.
Indeed, I would concur with you on that. And I think there's even evidence in the evolutionary history of what appeared to be unaccounted for leaps as well that I think also point in that direction. And by the way, you've used the word discombobulated twice now. Everyone jokes that I'm the only one who uses that word, so that's officially not true anymore. But yeah, I love that thought. And again, the fact that this, again, according to the way evolution is supposed to work and is supposed to be determined by the environment, right? And that you have these advantageous traits that come online based on the environment. Again, the logical sort of consensus thinking is that other planets with completely different environmental conditions would not give rise to humanoid beings that look so much like us and act so much like us. Whereas this kind of like a cosmic seeding of engineering that happened in ancient history or something. Either way, you have to make sense of not just that we exist with metacognitive capacities, but apparently there's some beings lying in freezers that don't look exactly like us, but are awfully similar.
Yeah, look, there is only so far in which speculation is useful, right? At some point, it becomes so ungrounded that it's not useful anymore. There are only two thoughts that I think are speculative, but which I think are worthwhile to consider. One is this seemingly scandalous hypothesis that we have been engineered may sound incredibly implausible, but the alternative is stupendously implausible. So we are dealing with two stupendous implausibilities.
The lesser of two implausibilities.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is no clean way out of this dilemma. Whatever we consider as a hypothesis will be highly implausible. That's one thought. The other thought is, who said that we are dealing with one and the same phenomenon in all cases here? Maybe the high strangeness thing is one thing, and the body is in the freezer and the craft in a hangar are something else. And are they related? Of course they are. Everything in nature is related. So they can evoke one another in certain patterns that are recognizable. That doesn't necessarily make them one and the same thing, even though they are most definitely related. So these are the two thoughts that I believe. I think, you know, we worry a lot about how our worldviews can become unstable and can become berserk if we acknowledge whatever lies behind the UAP phenomenon, whatever is known by segments of humanity. But I submit to you that the world view we have had so far this physicalist worldview in which we actually believe, we sincerely believe this crap. It is the most dysfunctional worldview you could have. Anything from here on is a step forward. So I don't think we should be too worried about how people are going to reconcile it in their own lives, because it whatever comes out of it, even if it puts us in the position of being rats in the lab, rats in the lab are more natural than the absolutely unnatural, absolutely dysfunctional, pathological worldview, according to which we have been living for the past four centuries.
I would agree with you. I was just going to say the word that comes to mind is pathological. I would also point out too, from either an idealist point of view or a non-dual point of view, that these beings, there seems to be evidence that some of them anyway, develop basically a non-dual understanding, which of course is understandable if they are also alters within original mind. And in that sense, how they would consider us as quote-unquote rats in a lab would be different, because they would also recognize that in some way we also are fractal elements of source consciousness. So this is one thing I point to.
And look, I've never said this, although it's a thought I have been entertaining for quite a while. I normally don't get the opportunity to start talking about the implications of idealism, because I have to put all my focus into defending idealism to begin with. And the implications are the conversation we will have in 20 years.
Right.
But of course, I live idealism, so I cannot help but think about the implications. Under idealism, our body is what our mental inner life looks like when observed from the outside. Our body is a dashboard representation of mental states when somebody else is measuring those mental states, or even when we ourselves measure those states by looking down or looking into the mirror. The thing is, we have layers and layers of internal dissociation for evolutionary reasons. The ego as a mental complex does not need to have associative access to the mental complexes that correspond to your liver, to your kidneys, because those are autonomous functions. They don't require deliberation. They don't require decision-making. So they are dissociated from the ego complex. And we are a bag of complexes. Now, what is under the skin is the extrinsic appearance of a bag of dissociated inner mental complexes. And what that means is that although we can deliberately change the contents of our ego mind, which have a physical correlation. If you're measuring my brain activity with a functional MRI or an EEG cap or an MEG, you will see that the patterns of electrochemical activity in my head, they will change according to how I deliberately change my thoughts and feelings. In other words, my mental causation has a physical correlate. And through feedback mechanisms, and this has been shown multiple times, through feedback mechanisms, you can even deliberately adopt a certain pattern of brain activity. That's how you can use mind to control a video game. In other words, by getting feedback into how your mental processes look like from the outside, you can calibrate them and tune them so they look like what you want them to look like. But we are restricted to brain activity because that's where the ego complex is. We can't change the rest of the body because it's a bag of dissociated complexes. Now, if we evolve further, if life evolves further, it stands to reason, it's conceivable in a way that is logically consistent, that these internal dissociative boundaries could dissolve, and that a living being at some point in the future might have deliberate control over all internal mental processes. Now, that's tricky because depending on how you change your mind, you could die. If you change your mind in such a way that your heart stops beating, you're in trouble, which is the reason why we can't do that. There isn't an evolutionary advantage to this, only disadvantages. But in a different context, in a different ecosystem, given different challenges and opportunities in the environment, it is conceivable that other beings have evolved to take deliberate control over all, or at least a substantial part of their inner mental processes, which means that in the same way we can change the patterns of brain activity, those living beings could change what they look like. They could look like a gray alien, or they could look like a lizard. as long as both forms are compatible with the maintenance of life. So what I'm not saying that this is plausible. I'm not saying that I believe this. I'm just saying that within the logical system, conceptual and logical system of analytic idealism, this is conceivable. It is not incoherent or internally contradictory. And sometimes I relate that to the high strangeness aspect of the phenomenon in which the beings don't have consistent forms. Their form seems to reflect their observer, a kind of a shape-shifting that evokes through the symbol that the body is, something in the mind of the observer, deliberately. It's like I'm changing the symbol that my body is as a means to communicate with something else that does not share the same conceptual dictionary that I share. So I cannot communicate with it through language, through mathematical symbols. I can only communicate to that other life form through evoking things that are archetypal and therefore common to us all. And the only way to evoke archetypes is to symbolically evoke them by your mere presence and by how you look and how you sound. So that's one possibility, that there are dissociated alters out there that have gained deliberate metacognitive control of all their mental processes so they can change what they look like, changelings, essentially. Just in the same way that we can change what our patterns of brain activity look like in the brain scanner by using feedback. And that, for them, is a means of communication, similar to how a cuttlefish or an octopus or a squid communicates by looking different.
Right.
Right?
Camouflage.
The thoughts of a cuttlefish are visible. Because you see that in the way the light patterns in their skin changes. I used to dive a lot. I was an obsessed diver, scuba diver. So I interacted with a lot of cuttlefish in my time, and I admire them. So something like that, but much deeper, in which the inner mentation of the organism is perceivable in the very body form, so long as that body form remains compatible with, you know, the structures of life, the limits of metabolism. It is a conceivable form of communication that is way beyond our human categories today, but it's not logically contradictory. It is conceivable.
Indeed, and I think about some of the lore in terms of their communication often is that they don't really look that way. They're doing it for our sake. That's part of it. There's also the sense that you could argue that a major reason they show up in the way they do is to actually evolve our worldview, to expand, like basically collapse our current worldview and introduce completely new ways of seeing the world. And in that sense, it could be a kind of, again, engineering that is speeding us along this path of gaining metacognitive control of greater aspects of reality to which you speak of. So that's I think a really fascinating idea to consider.
You know, you're a software engineer, so you studied optimization theory, you know, traveling salesman, simulated annealing, all those beautiful optimization problems. And so you know that one of the key problems in optimization theory is to avoid local minima. It's when you're trying to optimize something or reduce the cost of a certain function, trying to make things better in some way, and then you improve things, and then, oh, here things are much better. But things are even better here. The problem is that to get from here to here, things have to get a little worse and then better again.
Yeah.
But when you are in the local minima, whichever way you go, things get worse. So you tend to want to be stuck there. And in optimization problem, we solve that by adding noise to the algorithm, sort of to shake it out of the local minima so it can find the global minimum, the global optimum. Because we are, you know, in the evolution of our own understanding, our own grasp of reality, because we are so obsessed with meaning and therefore complete victims of fluid compensation, we need closure. I mean, we just put $10 billion at CERN to fight a Higgs boson. Why do you think we did that? It's closure. We are in a desperate search for closure because we no longer live naturally. Maybe somebody engineered us out of nature. Because of that, we will get stuck in local minima. We will never part with narratives that work most of the times in favor of an alternative narrative that, before it makes things clearer, it makes things more confused. We will not escape local minima because of fluid compensation, because of our desperate need for closure. And what the phenomenon does is to add noise to the system.
The high strangeness is the noise.
Yes.
Right. Beautiful. I like that. That's definitely worth pursuing. All right, my friend. Well, it's probably, what time is it there now? Like midnight or something?
It's midnight.
All right. Okay.
But I sleep late. It's okay. It's been a pleasure, Darren.
Yeah, I appreciate it too, and hope we can talk again.
All right.
All right.
Thanks for this.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and gain access to all my additional content, including OTC Squared and feature series, and access to my private Discord server, you can do so by either going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.